Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and yeah, we've had a bit of a week in the old InfoSec, lots of crazy stuff to talk about. We'll be recapping all the week's security news in just a moment with Adam Boileau. And then we're going to kick on into this week's sponsor interview. And this week's show is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. They make hardware honeypots and the tools you need to deploy Canary tokens at scale. They also make virtual honeypots. And this week, Thinkst's founder Haroon Mir will be along to wave his finger at basically all of us over what he sees as this discipline's tendency to not really learn anything from security conferences. It's all contertainment, he says. And then, of course, he says, get off my lawn. But no, Haroon will be along in a little while. And as usual, he'll be here making some excellent points. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, of course, the big breaking news of the week. The US indicted Huawei with about, 23 indictments. Of course, a lot of these are related to Huawei apparently operating in Iran in violations of various sanctions. But there was also some interesting stuff in there involving the theft of trade secrets.
Yeah, the indictments cover, financial fraud, some obstruction of justice charges, and the one that's been, people have been amused about, which is Huawei employees allegedly stealing trade secrets, and in particular details of a robot for testing mobile phones from US carrier T-Mobile. That doesn't seem, proportional to the, level of response we've seen against Huawei, at kind of governmental level around the West. But clearly there's no details in here of any charges relating to, espionage or the kinds of things that we, suspect Huawei has been up to. They got to start somewhere. And I suppose these are charges that they imagine, are going to stick and are, kind of keep things tarpeted, keep Ms. Meng where she is in Canada or on the extradition list in the meantime.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of an escalation when you look at just the relationship between the US and China at the moment. But I think the T-Mobile one, there's comedy value in a staffer, in a Huawei staffer stuffing like a robot arm in his bag and trying to like walk it out of the building. But there was already a lawsuit involving this thing that was settled. But I think the interesting part here is that it turns out Huawei was actually incentivizing and paying bonuses to staff for doing this sort of thing.
Yeah, that does seem a little bit sketchy.
That seems indictment worthy.
It kind of does. Obviously there's, wailing and gnashing teeth from China about it, but it really just does not look good for Huawei at all. I imagine there's plenty more coming down the pipe because if you're willing to bust sanctions to Iran and pay your employees to nick stuff from your customers, then, what else are you doing?
Yeah, well, that's a fair question. Now, in other news, of course, everyone woke up today to discover that there was this really bad logic bug in FaceTime. Although I got to admit, I found the reaction a little bit extreme, especially considering Apple were able to mitigate this at a server level pretty quickly. But this is a hell of a logic bug.
It really is. It's such a boneheaded bug, Apple, and it is good that they've kind of mitigated it relatively rapidly, but such a boneheaded bug. If you've been living under a rock for the last, 12 hours or whatever the internet speed moves at, you could just phone someone with FaceTime, and then whilst it was ringing, add yourself to a group call with them, and it would just turn the mic on, even if the person ignored the call or hung up on the call. Then you would still have a hot mic on their phone. And of course, they would have known that someone has tried to FaceTime them and it shows up in the logs, but you can just sniff their mic and then keep that group chat open, group call open for as long as you want, which is just, it's just such a stupid logic.
So it's for as long as you want, because I wondered whether or not it was just when it was ringing, but no, it's actually, you can hot mic someone, just set it up and keep it there all day.
I'm not 100% sure. A couple of guys did try it around the office and get some audio bits, but yeah, I wasn't quite clear how long you can leave the call up for. There were also reports that if the person being called pressed the power button on their phone to reject the call, then it would also light up the video, which, if you, have to be sitting in the bathroom perhaps and choose not to answer a call from someone, that might not be ideal. Apple have turned off group FaceTime messaging, which is the feature that was causing this to happen on the server side whilst they prepare a patch. But it's just really I mean, obviously, you know, it did get really wound up and people are going, oh, my God, government surveillance, which is clearly not. I mean, this is not a thing that the NSA is going to use because it's just, you know, it's not going to fit with their tradecraft requirements. So that bit of it was a bit hyperbolic. But on the other hand, such a stupid bug.
It is. It is. And I'm sure it'll be patched very soon. But, you know, I just got to say, though, if you're going to use a bug like that to turn on my camera while I'm in the bathroom, I think, you know, I'm not the one with the problem there. You know, probably the, the attacker there is the one with the issue. But, you know, I wanted to talk about that bug because, you know, okay, it's made a huge splash, but there's been this other one doing the rounds over about the last week. A listener sent this to me something like 6 days ago. And Adam, I get to tell you this now. You know what I told this listener about this bug that they sent me? I said, Adam's going to love this one. Was I right?
Yeah, you are so right. Yeah, someone pasted this in our internal work chat about the same time ago. And yeah, our red team guys are just all over it. There's been a write-up of kind of a bug chain rather than a particular bug, you know, a collection of misfeatures put together in Windows environments. The details of this are a little complicated, but the basic gist is if you are running Exchange, which let's face it, lots of people are, and you can talk to the Exchange web server on, you know, the local network. So typically this is going to be like you're on someone's corporate network or, you know, they have pretty bad egress filtering, so it's primarily an internal attack. You talk to the Exchange server, you convince it to connect back to you through like the mechanism for adding like RSS subscriptions. So basically you can ask the Exchange server to poll something on the internet to check it and then tell you about it later. And then you glue that to the kind of the existing things we understand about cross-protocol NTLM relay attacks. And at that point you've got the Exchange server's machine account, which is privileged in the Active Directory and has permissions to update you know, access control in the Active Directory and also replicate as a result of those permissions, which is a dumb thing. You can then glue all this together, take the incoming connection from the Exchange server, relay it via LDAP to the Active Directory, and then lead yourself onwards to replicating down hashes and privileged access to Active Directory. So, yeah, talk to Exchange, receive domain admin, which, yeah, pretty bad.
Yeah. So if you get a foothold on any network, you're a domain admin now. That's nice.
Well, yeah, pretty much. And yeah, I mean, everyone who runs Exchange and Active Directory, which is, you know, essentially every pre-cloud business. I mean, obviously, there's always going to be other ways. I mean, that's one of the joys of Windows networks is they're super complicated.
But this is going to save you some time. This is efficiency, Adam.
Yeah, well, I mean, these kinds of, you know, generic, non-site-specific techniques for going from, you know, any auth level to domain admin are just workhorse bugs for everybody who breaks into Windows networks, you know, BU, you know, real nation-state hackers, you know, recreational hackers, pen testers. We all use these bugs. And, yeah, this one is just going to, you know, everyone will be all over this and everyone who didn't already have domain admin but did have a local account in networks has got domain admin through this bug in the last week. So, yeah, sucks.
Now, of the two bugs that we've just spoken about or of the two attacks that we've just spoken about, which do you think is more high impact?
Well, yeah, like that's a pretty good point, isn't it?
And which one, Adam, got more attention?
But then again, Microsoft didn't take out billboards saying how good their security was.
True. Apple has been a little bit Oracle-like of late. That's totally fair. Yeah. Now, look, last time we recorded a news segment was 2 weeks ago, and we spoke about this. I think it was FireEye put out a blog post talking about Iranian operations where they were basically, you know, breaking into people's registries or registrars or whatever and, you know, fiddling with domain name settings, obtaining valid certs through domain validated, you know, cert issuance services like Let's Encrypt, but not limited to Let's Encrypt. And we all, you know, you and I spoke about that and said, oh, gee, you know, that's a pretty nifty attack. But it turns out that that's been affecting an awful lot of people.
This particular campaign turned out to be the Iranians hacking a whole bunch of stuff, including U.S. government agencies. So the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency published an alert basically telling U.S. government and requiring U.S. government agencies to go and review their DNS records to make sure they haven't been modified, to audit exactly where all the DNS is, and to then explain to the DHS exactly why they can't multi-factor auth it. You know, the suggestion is they should multi-factor auth it, of course, within 2 weeks, I think, 10 days, which, you know, for third-party rubbish providers might be a challenge. But yeah, that's a pretty, you know, pretty stark sign that this got used for bad things.
Yeah, well, I actually got some audio here from Chris Krebs, who heads the CISA agency, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. It's got security in the name twice. That's what we like in an agency. And, you know, if you sort of read between the lines of what he's saying here, he's like, you know, they issued the directive because there was a government shutdown, but there were still enough people on deck to handle this. But, you know, like issuing a directive would make sure it got kicked up in terms of priority. Here's what Chris had to say.
So we do know that U.S. government infrastructure was impacted. We're still sorting out to what extent, and really at the same time working with our private sector partners and other nations to understand the true global scale of this event. And in doing so, partnering, coordinating, communicating throughout with the security community in consultation with the IT security teams across civilian agencies, federal U.S. agencies, Office of Management and Budget, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, all culminating initially, at least last Tuesday, with the release of Emergency Directive 19-01. That basically lays out four specific protections that we asked required agencies to implement within 10 business days. So just real quickly, I won't get too much into the four, the technical details of the four requirements, but first is verify the DNS records are resolving where they're intended to resolve and they're not redirected elsewhere. Update DNS account passwords. Add multi-factor authentication to the accounts that manage those records. And then we are providing some outside additional assistance to agencies, and we're providing certificate transparency logs. And we're asking agencies to look at those logs and make sure that the certificates issued are in fact the certificates requested by the agency, and alert us all along if they find any discrepancies. We recognize that even in non-shutdown times, so we did just come out of this 35-day partial government shutdown here in the U.S. that put a lot of strain on IT security teams and IT teams in general. We recognize that even in a normal operating environment that the abuse that presented by this DNS tampering could succeed if agencies didn't have tight control over their DNS. Interestingly, though, we do have some indication that the bad guys, the actors here, were especially active over the holidays when we think, perhaps, that not necessarily because the government was shut down, but because they anticipated fewer people at work doing security. So there was the timing of this, whether it was shut down or not, that there was urgent acted needed. And we do believe that there were key personnel at work in those agencies despite the shutdown. Even though they were limited to a narrow set of activities given the shutdown, they could still act. And so all these factors together, the activity, the shutdown, that there were folks in place to act, it really did draw out a sense of urgency from us.
Long-time listener and first-time caller Chris Krebs there of the CISA agency giving us some context on why they issued that emergency directive. But yeah, it makes sense. He did send me a few other points as well. Like, I think he's a bit sick of people saying they should use DNSSEC because, as he pointed out, like that wouldn't really get you very far in this situation, right?
No, it would be completely useless in this particular case. The thing I did like about their response, other than, you know, suggesting multi-factor auth, which is a good idea, is the focus on using certificate transparency logs, because they really are the one great weapon that defense has against this, you know, kind of abuse of the DNS and the TLS infrastructure. Cert transparency is such a wonderful idea, and it does work really well. And seeing agency like the CISA encouraging people to use that and providing with them with tooling support and data support to process, what can be a pretty unwieldy fire hose of logs if you're trying to use it yourself. That's really good, and I would certainly encourage everybody to, look at their options for using CD to keep track of certificates that got issued that they didn't mean to.
Yeah, and Chris says you can head over to cyber.dhs.gov for some more information. But, you know, like we've actually seen an alert come out of the NCSC as well, right? So these guys are prolific, let's just say that.
Yeah, clearly they've been busy. And it's a great example of the sort of unglamorous hacking that totally works that you do when hacking is your actual job, as opposed to
and when everyone's on holidays. And then there's a shutdown for bonus points, right?
Like, yeah, they must have been having, you know, so much. You made the joke last week with Alex about overtime. All of the, you know, state hackers outside the US. Yeah, I'm sure they all got unpaid, did not get their overtime.
I'm not sure what industrial relations law is like in Iran. Not sure if they were getting any overtime there, but they sure as hell deserved it. Now, this is a hilarious story, really, is, you know, Citizen Lab. We often discuss Citizen Lab's reports here on the show. They're often looking at spyware made by various firms popping up on human rights activists' phones, things like that. They got approached in Meatspace by a couple of obvious spies, right? Like working for a private company. So what they did is great. They set up a meeting with these people and then got Associated Press journalists to like hang back at the next table and then sort of spring out and start asking questions and taking photos. And it turns out since then, they published their photos. The guy who was photographed has been linked to an Israeli private intelligence firm named Black Cube. This was the firm that Harvey Weinstein famously hired to try to sort of smear his victims. I mean, what can you even say about this story?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of funny in one level, right? I mean, the sort of clumsy private spying, you know, sort of thing is, you know, it's easy to laugh at their rubbish, you know, rubbish tradecraft, I guess, because you read spy novels and expect all spies to be amazing. But on the other hand, I mean, there is a more sort of serious subtext to it, which is when you see the work that Citizen Lab, the amount of times we've reported on their work, and you go, well, you know, you're going to be messing with some people who are not going to be happy about what you're doing, and eventually there are going to be risks to the individual researchers and to the organization.
Sure, sure, but I mean, this was hilarious. Like, it was an obvious plot to try to entrap them into saying nasty things about Israel, right? Because NSO is an Israeli firm, so you've got these Black Cube guys there turning up with literal cue cards, right? Asking them questions like, why are you doing so much work on NSO? Do you hate Jews? Like, it was just the most ridiculous thing. I've actually got some audio here from Claudio Guarnieri, who is, of course, a technologist with Amnesty International and works with Citizen Lab on various things. And here's what he said.
Unfortunately, most of these cases are not discussed in public. So I think this case from Citizen Lab is a good learning lesson for human rights defenders out there. What makes this one particularly troubling is that it goes beyond just, you know, intelligence gathering and extends into fundamentally attempting at entrapment of Citizen Lab in saying bad things to discredit their reputation and discredit their findings. You know, it turns out that these guys these operatives appear to be connected to Black Cube, who seems to have an history in doing dirty work for sketchy clients. To me, there is still the open questions of who might have hired these people. It's still not that obvious to me. It could be a different amount of interested parties. I guess we'll find out more in the weeks to come. The sloppiness of the operatives to me is still quite hilarious and underwhelming in a way. I mean, reading from cue cards and whatnot and using spy pens, putting them on the table. I mean, it all kind of seems like coming out of a bad spy comedy movie. But nevertheless, I really commend my friends from Citizen Lab and being on point and exposing these clowns.
Yeah, so I mean, I actually had a bit of a chat with Claudio, and it is a bit of a head scratcher in terms of who might have done this, because the obvious answer is NSO, but like, it's just as likely to be some company that's interested in acquiring NSO that wants to see if there's any more dirt coming, right? Like, we just don't know. This smells like it's about money, not necessarily anything else.
Yeah, it does seem, you know, that's, you know, there's lots of reasons why it could happen. And yeah, I mean, NSO, it seems a bit transparent for NSO. Like, they would be the obvious place to point the finger, and you'd think that that would cause them to think twice about it. And as you say, there could be plenty of other people who are interested for some reason and, you know, didn't necessarily get the most competent people. But you really got to wonder whether you're going to see, you know, the sort of a Phineas Fisher style, group, activist, whatever, decide to go after Black Cube, for example, to go and pull this particular thread. Like, maybe they've drawn a little bit too much interest on themselves now, and people are curious about this answer. So, yeah.
It almost sounds like you're trying to not so subtly incite a crime there, Adam. And I'd love to talk about all of their internal docs, you know, but, and I'm not trying to incite anyone to do anything either, but it would be interesting. I will say that.
Yeah, no one's inciting. No inciting is being done. None whatsoever.
Moving on, and I got this great story here from ZDNet, written by Catalin Kimpanu, which is about, look, what I think is a really sensible plan by the Japanese government to log into everyone's crappy router with their default credentials and change them as a defensive approach so that Japanese home routers don't wind up joining things like Mirai botnets. What do you think of this? Because I think this is great.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think a very pragmatic idea. And it's kind of, if you tried that in most places, I'm thinking of the paperwork of a local cert, say the New Zealand cert, asking them to go log into everyone's rubbish IoT devices in New Zealand, all that they would do is end up in 6 months of meetings, right? And it would never happen because everyone would be too afraid of it. So it's kind of nice to see, an agency actually decide to do something pragmatic and useful here. And, it's going to step on some toes. And I mean, if, for example, there happens to be a thing that looks like a home router but actually is an MRI, and when you log into it with admin, it actually kills someone instead of just logging you in, which, let's face it, is pretty far-fetched, then they may rethink it. But as a pragmatic option, and especially given some of the rationale here is that Japan is saying, well, we've got the Olympics coming up in Tokyo, and they're worried about the sorts of things that happen with botnet DDoS attacks on the Olympics in South Korea, and therefore we need to go shut down IoT devices in Japan, which obviously there's plenty of other IoT devices in the world that don't have to be in Japan, but hey, it's not a bad idea. And I don't think they're proposing to actually change the creds of the devices. I think they're proposing to log in, validate that the default creds work, and then attempt to contact the subscriber that's responsible for the circuit and get them to fix it, which, that sounds like a long slog.
Just change the creds. Go rogue. Come on.
Who's inciting? Jeez.
But look, I included this next piece as sort of like a counterpoint to the first one, which is often when you're doing things on the internet, there are unexpected consequences, like when you're screwing around with BGP.
Yeah, this research group of academics were doing some research about BGP route validation, and were doing some testing by announcing some routes with some particular control, route propagation controls on them, and then looking to see how those were propagated throughout the global network. And yeah, it turns out it triggered a bug in some Linux BGP implementation and DOSed a whole bunch of people, which was not exactly what they expected. And then they got the bug fixed in this particular implementation, did it again, DOSed a whole bunch more things. Apparently, this particular university in Brazil has now decided not to do this anymore.
Yeah, that's probably good advice there, right? Like, don't mess with fragile routing equipment that doesn't know how to parse exotic BGP extensions.
On the other hand, right, they got bugs fixed in the internet infrastructure, so, seems like a good outcome to me.
Chalk that up as a biscuit, no biscuit situation, sort of like a neutral biscuit situation.
Anti-biscuit.
This next story from the New York Times has actually caused a big ripple among business people, among directors, because there's been a lawsuit involving the Yahoo breach and money awarded. But what's got everyone terrified is that this was a shareholder's lawsuit, not a user's lawsuit. We've seen plenty of users sue companies after there's been a breach and they get their $1.50 each in free credit monitoring. This is different. This is shareholders taking action against a company. And although the amounts involved aren't huge, people are really paying attention to this.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting case for a couple of reasons. So this is a lawsuit by the shareholders against the management of Yahoo, alleging that they did not carry out their fiduciary duty in responding to the data breaches in the right way over the various years. This particular class of corporate law where shareholders can sue directors and management apparently has a particularly kind of high bar. Like, it's a particularly complicated thing to get a win out of. And in this particular case, Yahoo's insurer settled it, which is an interesting twist in it. But yeah, they, the way that they mismanaged it clearly, did constitute some mismanagement. And the fact that the shareholders are going to get a payout for that, is an interesting development that I'm sure has, ruffled the feathers of lots of people in management. But yeah, the aspect with the insurers is interesting because Yahoo had bought insurance to cover the directors from liability in this particular kind of, scenario, which is super messed up to start with, like spending the company's money on that insurance to cover themselves personally. But the fact that the insurer paid out...
Well, it turned out to be a good decision really, for them, didn't it?
Well, I don't know what it did. But for the insurer to pay out, they must have been really sure they were going to lose for them to offer to settle.
That's right. That is linked through to in this week's show notes. Now, we saw another little supply chain attack, this PHP Pair website. Now, I've got to admit, I'd never heard of PHP Pair. And of course, you know, what is this? This is like a PHP like application packaging and updating thing. What is Pair?
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of like, say, NPM to Node, right? It's a way to install pre-packaged releases of PHP software. It's not the most popular one anymore, but it is one that's been around for a long time and one that was bundled.
I'm going to just get you to hold up there because I got some audio here from Katie Anton, who's a principal application security consultant at Vericode and also runs the OWASP Top 10 Proactive Controls project. Here's what she said about Pair. And yeah, she's very much of the same mind as you, which is nobody really uses it anymore.
Despite the fact that Pair Download Manager comes pre-installed on Unix, Linux, BSD systems, this packaging solution has caused many headaches for many PHP developers. And this is why, over time, has been slowly replaced by other solutions, like Composer, for example, which is the default packaging solution for most frameworks. Pair might be used by legacy applications. What is worth noting, though, is that the compromise of Pair packaging comes 2 months after a widely used third-party Node.js module was compromised by one of its open-source contributors and was infected with malicious code. The supply chain compromise is an increasing trend.
Yeah, so I mean, like, if Katie hadn't mentioned that was 2 months ago, I totally would have forgotten. But this seems to be something that's happening more and more.
Yeah, well, it's a great example of hacking that works, right? I mean, you've only got to get your code in somewhere, and remote code exec through, you know, Markdown-style bugs is the glamorous way to do it. But, you know, hacking some ancient PHP packaging system or, you know, a node rubbish node module totally works. And why not do it? You know, supply chain is, you know, it's the year of supply chain. As we have said, I think you said last year.
Well, that was last year, man. Come on. This is like the year of, like the next year after the year of, I don't know what it's the year of yet. But I will note that.
It's the year of supply chain on the desktop.
Supply chain on the desktop. That's good. Look, unless you're living under a rock, you know that things are getting pretty tense in Venezuela. And there's been a lot of news doing the rounds saying that the government there has been blocking the internet. And that is and isn't true. I spoke to Arturo Filasto of the Open Observatory of on Network Interference, and he had some interesting stuff to say about this. He said that, you know, when Guaido, who's the now the guy who's being recognized as the Venezuelan president by the United States and most Latin American countries and some European countries, Australia, all of that, when his Wikipedia entry started getting edited, there were like 37 edits in rapid succession. It was around that time that people in Venezuela were having trouble reaching Wikipedia. So there was a bit of a ban that happened there, but now it's available. And what he's noticed is that the sophistication of blocking has actually come along. They were doing DNS-based blocking, but now they're doing SNI-based blocking. Wikipedia is now available. The interesting thing, though, is that they seem to be pulling down Instagram when this guy is giving speeches, right, to just sort of try to minimize the reach. Here's what Arturo said.
Yeah, so another interesting thing that we have noticed, particularly in relation to the blocking of Instagram, is that this type of blocking is not persistent across time. It seems to be focusing on particular short periods of time where they will sort of flick on the blocking of Instagram, and for maybe 1 or 2 hours, it will be blocked, and then it will be lifted after that. And what we've heard from rumors from people there, it seems that this may be related to some live streams that Juan Guaido has been doing on Instagram in the form of some speeches, and the government may be trying to limit access to these streams while they are happening live to make engagement be a bit reduced.
Now, the interesting thing that Arturo told me is that it's not, they can't be certain about blocks on other services because, of course, when these services are going down, there's like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets and it could just be overloaded internet. But what they can say is that I think it was Wikipedia and Instagram were definitely getting SNI filtered, and that's government censorship. But this just seems like the beginnings of something that could escalate. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it demonstrates a more, I guess, sophisticated approach to blocking and interfering with social media and you know, communication on the internet in general. I mean, doing that kind of filtering of a particular service at a particular time to stop a particular, you know, message propagating versus, you know, the kind of blanket bans on social media we've seen, you know, rather ineptly used elsewhere, which just result in you know, a whole bunch of people becoming aware of that interference that otherwise might not have noticed it. Whereas this is a little more targeted, and people are going to go, oh, well, you know, there's people in the street, maybe the tubes are clogged. You know, it's a little bit more deniable in a way, although obviously we've got specific technical evidence here. But yeah, just I guess seems a little more sophisticated.
Ukraine, meanwhile, is having a bit of trouble with the Russians, they say.
Yeah, well, I guess they've been having lots of trouble with the Russians. In particular, there's elections coming up in Ukraine in March. And, of course, the Russians love interfering with elections. And I imagine interfering with the Ukrainian election is super high on their list. Although I gather, I think both the main candidates are not exactly pro-Russia. So I don't know what they're doing there.
Can you imagine trying to get elected in Ukraine right now by being pro-Russia? Like, I don't think that's going to happen.
You know. If you got enough support from Russian interference, maybe. But no, there's been a campaign underway to compromise, you know, accounts and information relating to people who work in the operation of the elections, which does not bode well. There's been phishing campaigns and kind of campaigns luring people who work there and people who, you know, are related to people who work there as a starting point for those sorts of things. And yeah, that just does not sound like a good time.
No, it doesn't. But I wonder how effective an approach like this can be, given what we know now about 2016. You know, like even if you get the data, like people are going to eye it skeptically. But meanwhile, a British think tank, this is a story from Kevin Collier, who was with BuzzFeed. But, you know, I just didn't realize that 50% of Twitter was actually BuzzFeed reporters until they got laid off. And then my entire feed was just full of BuzzFeed reporters saying, I got laid off today. But no, it's a very unfortunate. And Kevin was one of those who was actually let go, which is super weird because he's a very, very accomplished and talented reporter. This looks to be his final piece with BuzzFeed, which is, you know, a Russian hack against a UK think tank that is countering Russian information operations, which is, I guess you might call that a little ironic.
Well, yeah, and you got to wonder, like, if you're running a think tank specifically to counter Russian information ops, you kind of ought to expect to have some, you know, information ops perhaps against you and perhaps take the appropriate precautions. I don't know what the appropriate precautions are, clearly. But yeah, I mean, it really it's kind of just what you expect, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this think tank is called the Integrity Initiative. Its parent organization is the Institute for Statecraft, which received most of its funding in the last 2 years from the British government. They got owned late last year, and, you know, people are putting their files online. I guess it just goes to show, right? If you're part of an organization that's doing like chemical weapons testing or like combating Russian disinformation, you're going to be a target, right? Facebook is apparently going to like merge Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook messaging. To which everyone said, "Whoa, hey, what about E2E?" But it looks like they're embarking on a pretty ambitious program here to like encrypt Instagram messages. In the first place, ahead of this integration, which tends to signal that maybe E2E is staying and they're going to do some weird merger that allows them to keep encrypted messaging.
Yeah, it's not 100% clear. I mean, a lot of the stories that have been going around are a little bit light on detail about exactly what they're planning. It sounds like, you know, integrated user directories and naming so that you have some way to reach people across the three different brands, but on the back end that there's some shared technical infrastructure and end-to-end messaging, which of course requires naming and that kind of thing to be able to do, you know, plus, you know, bodging these things together. Presumably there's a bunch of shared, you know, places where they could share infrastructure. You know, where WhatsApp infrastructure is better than Facebook Messenger or Instagram's messaging features, you know, whilst still providing the platforms their own kind of separate user-facing, you know, interface and features and things. But yeah, it's not 100% clear. I mean, some of the reporting is like, oh, they're going to combine them all and ruin Instagram and ruin Facebook and ruin WhatsApp, which, you know, may well be the case. I mean, I saw some reporting which suggested that this was one of the reasons that the You know, the original founders of WhatsApp and Instagram kind of departed Facebook towards the end of last year. But I don't know. It's a little bit murky to me. End-to-end crypto everywhere clearly would be a useful thing. What that means for their, you know, business model and advertising and learning and stuff, you know, I guess we'll have to see.
Ah, a couple of fun crypto stories. They're always a bit of fun. They're always good for a laugh, aren't they, Adam? But there's been some...
I'm laughing.
Yeah, there's been some crypto exchange in New Zealand, in your country, where, and I love this, like, their funds were still being drained after they called the cops.
Yeah, this is a Cryptopia local currency exchange here in New Zealand, which actually was quite big. Like, I handled quite a lot of customers, traded in a lot of really stupid cryptocurrencies. They were trying to build like a New Zealand dollar tethered one. Terrible idea as well. Yeah, they got owned, a whole bunch of money stolen. Yeah, the funny thing about the reporting so far is that, yeah, they phoned the New Zealand police, which, you know, I'm not sure if any of them listened to the show, but hi, I'm not sure those, the police are super experienced at dealing with, you know, cryptocurrency exchange heists. And yeah, all of the various currencies were being hoovered out, even as the police were rolling down there to, you know, presumably encase some discs like it's the year 1997. And yeah, lots of money's gone away. People have been watching the blockchains and seeing the money kind of disappear off into the, you know, into the ether, as it were. And yeah, I don't know that the future looks particularly bright for this currency exchange. But then again,
no,
that's kind of the case in general.
It is. But this next one, this is my favorite story this week. It is my absolute favorite. This dude set up a website where he's like, it's a seed generating website, right? So like, I'll generate a seed for you that you can use to secure your cryptocurrency wallets, right? For your IOTA cryptocurrency. And look, here's a link to the GitHub repo with the code in it, which will show you how these numbers are how these seeds are randomly generated. The thing is, Adam, that the website wasn't using the code that was in the GitHub repo. It was like a static like seed with an incrementing number at the end. So of course, once he collected enough seeds, he just went around draining wallets. But look, I almost wanted him to get away with it, right? Because it's a cool idea. He got away with like 10 million euros for this, but now he's been arrested in Britain. He's about to be extradited to Europe. Sad trombone. The first time I got to use the sad trombone button. But I mean, what do you even say, right?
That's such a good use of the sad trombone button. Yeah. I mean, it just illustrates so many aspects of, you know, like supply chain and software validation and third party services and, you know, entropy and cryptocurrency. Like, there's lots of, you know, lessons to be learned from there. But I think the main thing is just sad trombone.
Now, look, you know, there was some research that came out of EFF some time ago that found that these police license plate readers are still accessible from the internet using default passwords. I mean, what? This is terrible. I mean, I feel uncomfortable enough about the police having them, let alone every Tom, Dick and Larry.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, people buying rubbish IoT cameras and sticking them on the internet, the fact that they happen to be, you know, police or you know, council or, you know, local government run number plate recognition cameras clearly is a bad thing, although there are some private companies, I guess, who run them as well. The thing that I found that was interesting about this story, which I guess is not necessarily the security aspect of it, is that there is just open source software for doing license plate recognition. So you can just take any cam feed of a street, run it through the software and build your own database. And there's been some people who've done that, you know, with publicly accessible cameras or data that's been retrieved somewhere. And that in a way is kind of a more scary capability than there being a few hundred rubbish, you know, number plate cameras.
Well,
you know,
I don't know that I agree with you on that, man, because like these things, you know, if you can actually get access to the data that they're outputting, not just a camera feed, I mean, it becomes pretty powerful. I asked Eva Galperin from EFF to tell me what she thought about this, and here's what she said.
First of all, I wanted to give a quick shout out to my colleagues Cooper Quinton and Dave Moss, who did the original work finding open ALPR databases on Shodan. And I'm very glad that there are other researchers and journalists who are still following up on this. I'm not at all surprised to discover that governments and law enforcement have possibly not read this research or not taken their databases down off of the public internet. And I'm really concerned about the ways in which this data could potentially be used. This is potentially a trove of useful information for stalkers, for domestic abusers. And this is something that the police really should do something about.
I 100% agree with Eva Galperin of EFF.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, there's just so many ways that you can use this data for evil. And, you know, if you're going to buy and run these as a police agency or as a local government, then you absolutely have an obligation to do a good job of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting malvertising campaign. We don't actually have time to talk about this because we're running really low on time. But the interesting part of this is that they're dropping the payload as Stego in images, which I thought was kind of cool. Haven't seen that in a while. There's a Cisco bug out there. New exploit targeting Cisco routers. I mean, what's new? But someone actually posted a POC on GitHub, and we know that makes a difference.
Yeah, and of course, I suppose the new thing here is it's not a default cred. It is actually just that you don't need a cred to pull the config off them. So that's novel for Cisco, I guess.
True. Details on that one in this week's show notes. Now, look, the last thing I want to talk about this week, Adam, is Leslie Carhart from Dragos. A couple of weeks ago, kicked off a Twitter thread talking about how, you know, the building that she lives in, the building management had done a deal with a startup that does like smart home stuff. And they're like, okay, you need to plug this thing into your home router and it's going to control your front door. Now, she kicked off a Twitter thread about this and was saying like, I don't know that I really feel comfortable about this. And of course, you know, everyone's piling into the thread. She's got a zillion followers. So I guess some people sort of flagged her as an anti-IoT Luddite. She says that's definitely not the case, but that this is going to be a problem. And I tend to agree with her. When you've got these companies springing up, doing these smart locks and smart temperature control and whatnot, and doing deals with property developers and management companies that control like hundreds of thousands of condos, this has all of the hallmarks of a future security problem, right? So I asked Leslie to tell us a bit more about that, and here's what she said.
This particular company that they're working with is a startup. They're small, they're very new, but this migration is coming like a freight train. Their plan is to migrate tens or even hundreds of thousands of units in the short term. So looking into their system, myself and a lot of security people who are in these impacted buildings have raised a lot of questions, and we haven't gotten a lot of good answers from anyone. So the primary concern with the way they're deploying the system is that they have basically directed residents to connect their consumer smart hub to their home routers. And those consumer Z-Wave hubs will be controlling a smart lock and thermostat and all kinds of other goodies. So let's talk about the fundamental problems here. This is like a problem that is almost unfeasible to fix because of architecture. You have to fix the architecture. No consumer grade device that has normal interfaces on it, like Ethernet ports and serial ports, whatever, is ever going to stay secure in the long term when it's plugged into home network and physically accessible to all the users. You can do things to slow that down, like using no hard-coded creds and securing the device well, doing good audits, but you just can't leave a device like that out for every resident to access. There's also the concern of it being on a Wi-Fi network. So now we've got the thing that's controlling the lock to the door, which is a consumer device sitting out there on the person's personal network, probably WPA, WPA2. You know, it's 2019, it's not really that difficult to break into a lot of home wireless networks, and a lot of them do no segmentation whatsoever. So all of a sudden you're on the network with the hub, and once that hub is exploited, goodbye lock. Lock is reset to factory or lock is opened. It's just not a good situation. So my recommendation to smart home manufacturers and then the people buying those systems for their rental properties is lock those boxes up where they can't be accessed, physically accessed, and also put them on a commercial grade network, preferably a wired network. But regardless, you know, a secured network with some egress filtering and security monitoring. And keep that completely separate from your residence networks, especially their like personal home networks. It's just not a good idea. But that's aside from the privacy concerns of we have this relatively small company, and I'm sure it's full of really, really smart people securing like access codes and guest data and, data about when people enter and leave their homes for, again, tens or hundreds of thousands of people. That's a treasure trove for certain types of adversaries.
Now, it's really hard to disagree with anything she said there, although I think a recommendations bit is a bit optimistic because I can't imagine too many operators of like an apartment of apartment towers are going to go, great, we're going to throw in a wired network just for this. I mean, the whole appeal of a product like this is you don't have to do that because you can piggyback on the residents on the residents' networks, right? But like, would you want to plug one of these things into your network?
Hell no. And I mean, having seen, you know, kind of commercial building management networks in my work, like they're also terrible and I wouldn't trust them. Even, you know, a hardwired network, you know, in a locked cabinet in the basement of the building, they're still not good enough, right? I mean, the current access controls for commercial buildings are also awful. And yeah, the idea of deploying this in residential environments, you know, where the threat model in many ways is kind of more diverse, is just a terrible idea. And yeah, you're right. Like, nothing she says is wrong, but she is optimistic about whether it's even possible to do this well. Cause it's just, I mean, at startup scale as well, it's just not right. They're going to get ruined.
Well, I mean, she did make some other points there that I clipped them out for space, but she was saying, yeah, like, you know, startups, the emphasis isn't usually on security, right? So yeah. And she's 100% right. So I think that's just some, you know, just something to leave the listeners with, Adam, food for thought, but I just don't think that's a particularly wonderful thing, but it is certainly coming to an apartment near you soon. But mate, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for being back on deck and doing this week's show with me, and I'll chat to you again real soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. It's been fun. Oh yeah, talk to you next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mir, the founder of Thinxt Canary. Thinxt makes hardware honeypots that are ridiculously popular with very smart people. I have played around with one myself, and I can personally attest to the fact that they are very, very well executed. I haven't played with their virtual honeypots yet, but others have, and the feedback has been similarly excellent. You can also do a whole bunch of Canary tokens management through Thinxt's gear, so do check them out at canary.tools. But yeah, Haroon is not here this week to spruik Canary. He's here to talk about security conferences. Many, many years ago, I remember Thinxt offered an analysis service. It was mostly doing what I'd call specialist consulting back then, not products. And one of these services they'd offer was to track conference talks, to analyze what was on offer, and then present that analysis to subscribers. Basically as a way for people to keep their finger on the pulse of what sort of research was being presented out there and what might have a big impact. Haroon signed me up for that service for a while so I could see what it was all about. And holy moly, it wasn't until then, and this was like 6 or 7 years ago, but it wasn't until then that I realized just how many conference talks there are those days, let alone these days, right? You know, you hear those statistics like there's 250 babies born every minute. Con talks are getting up there, right? Similar sort of stats. So all the way back then, after taking in a macro view of the whole thing, Haroon formed some opinions that he actually turned into a con talk about con talks. He did that one at 44Con in 2013, and I've linked through to it on YouTube in this week's show notes. But yeah, look, a lot of the criticisms he had back then still stand. If anything, it's gotten worse now. But whose fault is that? According to Haroon, it's not necessarily the con organizers. The fault, dear Brutus, may lie within ourselves. Anyway, another thing he said that was interesting back then is that looking at what conferences are featuring is a really good proxy for understanding where we're at as a discipline. Like, you know, doing stunt hacking instead of solving our day job problems. Anyway, here's what Haroon had to say about that.
I still think it makes a good proxy. And interestingly, like even until really recently, I've met other speakers who are talking about stuff that they do at their company. And I happen to know that their company is takeable 6 ways from Sunday. And that's not to say people shouldn't share their knowledge, but again, it's a really good proxy for the industry, because lots of times you find that people have chosen to go down this niche path when actually they're completely missing the wood for the trees, because they takeable a whole bunch of other ways. So I certainly think for all the good that conferences do, they also open us up to the problem, because they give you a massive hit of dopamine every time you give a talk, and people get addicted to that high. And attendees, for the most part, are just not demanding enough or not demanding enough in any serious way. So there's a lot of junk that just happens to sail by and nobody seems to care as long as they got their afternoon out, got to make a badge with blinky lights, and got to take a picture with some famous hacksaw.
Now, this is one thing that you described again in this 2013 talk that I think still applies today, and I'm not sure how to feel about this criticism because you've described conferences as largely consisting of, you know, kind of technology-based entertainment, which I think, you know, depending on the talk, is a fair criticism. You know, like the question being, how much do we actually learn from some of these, you know, particularly talks that make a big splash? You know, how much do we learn from them? How much do we actually put into practice from these talks? But then again, I go to some other events. Admittedly, I don't go to many conferences these days. But I was over in New Zealand for KiwiCon, and there was PurpleCon before that, which was more of a, you know, sort of defender-oriented con.
Right.
And I thought there were some teachable things in that, right? So I kind of feel like maybe that's changing.
So I'll tell you, I'm not convinced it's changing too much, for one thing. But I'll tell you, it's easy to confuse that criticism with what's being said. But I'm less interested in what's being said there, and more trying to nudge us for how we're listening. Like, people always criticize DEF CON, and I know I'm in a super, super minority here, but I genuinely love DEF CON. Like I've almost never been to a DEF CON without coming away with at least two or three things that became interesting research for me the following year. Because, like, genuinely, it's some of it's unpolished, but it gives you a nugget that you go back home with and play with, and it leads you down the sort of rabbit hole that good things come out of. But what really scares me, and like, we've been to cons for a long time, and I've seen guys from our company, like way even the previous company and now. So I've seen enough of this: go to a conference, attend, listen to the talk, go, wow, Halva is clever, wow, Kaminsky is funny, and then go back to work. If you're not going back with a, I should try that thing, or he did this, I wonder if it has some application that I can use this way, then actually you just watched a TED talk. And at that point, it's completely just contertainment because
it's TED talks it's meat space TED talks. You know, instead of doing it on YouTube, we're doing it in real life.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what it is, because for that period, you got to hang with your posse and you get to say that that's what you did. So I think the contertainment problem is a big one, because I think if as a rule of thumb, if you're going back from a conference or you've been to multiple conferences and not come back and actively played with something or actively tried something, then I submit that the conference is kind of like potato chips for the mind, because this stuff should be encouraging us. If it's a hacker con to go back and hack stuff, if it's a security con to go back and try stuff, and if you're not doing that, there's a very real danger that you're just passing time.
Now, look, one thing that I've actually found fascinating, you know, again, referencing a six-year-old talk, but just as relevant today as it was then, is this isn't a problem that's specific to InfoSec. I mean, it seems like, you know, events planners are taking over the world and taking over every industry.
So for the most part, you're right. It does seem to be a problem across a whole bunch of industries. Doctors have the same problem. Psychologists have the same problem. And again, the thing that always disappoints me, or sometimes disappoints me with our industry, is that it's specifically counter to what we should be doing. Like much of the hero worship stuff that happens at cons, man, we cut our teeth on the mentor saying, this is the future and this is the place where you only judged by what you do. And I feel that stuff pretty deeply when I go to cons. Mainly, I just want people to say, hey, like, this is a cool idea. Let's go try it, or let's go fiddle with that stuff. Again, I think cons are amazing. Like, they've certainly changed my life, as lame as that sounds. Early SensePost, we did cons, and those cons led to training and led to more talks. And it allowed a small South African company to basically be at least in our niche famous. So there's a lot of good that comes out of it. But I am worried that that stuff's going away now with a con every day of the week. And I'd like it to at least bring back some of the signal.
So, you know, how would you recommend that con organizers might do that?
Con organizers...
I mean, it's not... I mean, as you keep saying, I mean, the fault is not in the stars. Dear Brutus, it's in ourselves, right? Like, it's less nice. About the con... And this is a dilemma in media as well, right? Which is like, right. You know, giving people what they want versus, you know, making them eat their vegetables, right? So if you spring up a conference that's all, you know, totally dry, no one's going to come.
Yeah, we had this talk a few times. So we used to do ZAcon, and at some point I said I didn't want people making electronic badges because it irritates me that there's speakers who've worked for months on their talk and everyone's focused on soldering an LED and a button to take an Instagram picture on a badge. And it's like, pay attention to the talk. Someone worked really hard on that.
You can see you at the front with a ruler, slash, yeah. You know, eyes front.
Yeah, in the end, I just about stopped with ZAcon when I figured maybe I'm the wrong guy. Like maybe my thoughts on that stuff are too old-fashioned. But the honest answer is I don't know. I think most people have to try. And that's why, like, as I get older, I'm being less prescriptive to the con organizers, because I think they're going to do what's in their best interest. And more than anything, I want to appeal to con attendees that say, like, don't do this mindlessly. Like, go there, actually choose
take wisely. Away and stuff. Where I see the interesting stuff happening is more on the developer side, right? Like, you look at some of the content that comes out of these, you know, AppSec conferences, and it's good, right? And it's actionable and usable. And that's weird that, like, a bunch of developers are, like, kind of teaching us how to con.
It's kind of fascinating. Like I tweeted about this a few weeks back, but I downloaded more talks from AWS reInvent this year than I've done from any security con in recent memory. And these are talks from AWS on their infrastructure and that's kind of amazing. And it's super interesting. It's an amazing time to be alive and to be doing some of this stuff. And for the most part, yeah, I just wish more people spend their time doing that sort of stuff, because otherwise it's just a waste.
In other words, eat your vegetables, everyone. Eat your vegetables. They're good for you. Haroon Mir, it has been a pleasure as always. Thank you very much for joining us on the show. And again, big thanks to Thinkst Canary for its sponsorship of the Risky Business Podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Pat.
That was Haroon Get Off My Lawn Mir there with a critique of conning. Big thanks to him for that, and huge thanks to Thinkst for its continued support of the Risky Business Podcast. You can go to canary.tools and check out their stuff. Hand on heart, it is actually very useful. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.